Radio Times. Arthur Opp, one of the narrators of Liz Moore's new novel Heft, is an obese former college professor who has been a lonely shut-in living in Brooklyn since shortly after September 11th. Kel Keller, the other narrator in Heft, is a star high school baseball player who cares for his alcoholic mother. This unlikely pair has some things in common. Kel's mother was Opp's student, with whom he was falsely accused of having an affair. The middle-aged man and the teenager also have troubled and confused relationships with their fathers. Liz Moore joins us on Radio Times to talk about the characters in her new novel. It's her second novel. She's also a musician who worked at a well-known music store in New York City, had a band, released a CD a couple of years ago called Backyards. And Liz Moore, congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here, and I'd love to begin with a reading from the very beginning of your book.
Absolutely. This does open the book. The first thing you must know about me is that I am colossally fat. When I knew you, I was what one might call plump, but I am no longer plump. I eat what I want, and furthermore, I eat whenever I want. For years, I have made very little effort to reduce the amount that I eat, for I have seen no cause to. Despite this, I am neither immobile nor bedridden, but I do feel winded when I walk more than 6 or 7 steps, and I do feel very shy and sort of encased in something, as if I were a cello or an expensive gun. I have no way of knowing exactly what I weigh, but I estimate that it is between 500 and 600 pounds. The last time I went to a doctor's office was years ago, and back then I weighed 480 pounds, and they had to put me on a special scale. The doctor looked at me and told me I was very surely on a path toward early death. Second, in my letters to you these 2 decades, I have been untruthful by omission. For shortly after I last saw you, a variety of circumstances combined to make it impossible for me to continue my academic career. About this, about many things, I have been unforthcoming. My references to former friends and colleagues are memories. I have not worked as a professor for 18 years. Last and most important, I no longer go out of my house. Fortunately, it is a very nice house, and largely I am proud of it. I did not purchase it. It was bestowed upon me. It is 25 feet wide, very wide for this block. And once it was very lovely inside and out, decorated very nicely. Oh, this was when I was a small boy. But now I fear I have allowed it to fall into a sort of haunted disrepair. Only scraps of its loveliness remain. The piano, I played when I was a boy. The bookshelves around the fireplace. The furniture, which once was what they might call high-end, but at this point has been sinking slowly toward the floor for 40 years, because it has borne the weight of me on its back. There are nice things on the upper floors, I suppose, but I haven't seen them in a decade. I have no reason to go up there. I couldn't if I tried. My bedroom and everything I need are on this floor, my little world, and outside my window is the only view I need. The state of the house is one of the things I'm most ashamed of. For I have always loved the house, and sometimes, when I am feeling sentimental, I feel the house loves me as well.
Mm. And that's our guest, Liz Moore, reading from the very beginning of her new novel. The novel is called Heft, and that's Arthur Opp, one of the narrators. Were there risks in your own mind as a writer to have a character that was so obese, 500, 600 pounds?
Absolutely. I think there are always risks that you have to take as a writer to make a book interesting in some way. But this one was a particular one, and I think partly because obesity and overweight are so frequently talked about in kind of the national discourse today, that it's a polarizing topic. Everybody has a specific opinion about it. In my case, I wanted to write an individual, and I didn't want him to represent any movement, and I didn't want him to represent anything other than himself, kind of. And so, despite the fact that I personally am not obese, I felt it was important to Arthur himself to be, all of his characteristics sort of arrived at the same time for me, and his obesity was part of him the way, you know, his height was.
Well, I'm interested in that. It's mm-hmm. always interesting how a character, you know, arrives or, mm-hmm. or comes to a writer, whether his weight was something that came as you got to know him or whether that was an image you had of him mm-hmm. right off the bat.
Well, for me, Arthur's loneliness is probably maybe more important than his obesity, or at least as important as his obesity. So for me, I when I first wrote a short story regarding Arthur, he was the central character in the short story in about 2006. And the problem with that short story is that nothing happened in it. It was about a man who was morbidly obese, and he was lonely, and he was stuck in this beautiful, decrepit brownstone in Brooklyn, and that was it. And it was really a character sketch. So I the character never left me, and I always felt like I wanted to write a longer work about him. But in order to be able to write a novel about him, I needed to be able to find some conflict for him, and that's when Cal Keller arrived.
Well, and certainly a backstory, because he's, as having read the book, he's a wonderfully warm person. I mean, he's a lovable character in all his troubles.
I think so. I mean, Arthur is beloved. I mean, for me, he's beloved, and I care about him deeply, and I hope that other people who will read his story will too. And so, I mean, he's just so, every part of him is so wrapped up in, I find his weight inextricable from the rest of him. So I don't even necessarily think about it as writing an obese character. I think about it as writing Arthur Opp.
Writing about Arthur Opp. Did you do any research on people who are shut-ins, and one gets the sense that he even hoards things, where it's hard for him to let go of things. Did you do research on that, or did you just follow your instincts or your imagination?
I did do some research on it. For one thing, there are a lot of mundane complicating factors that one wouldn't necessarily think about, such as the fact that pants are only manufactured up to about a size 72, a 72-inch waist for men.
And you know that from
and
your
I
research.
I know that from my research, exactly. And so there are complicating factors that I felt had to be addressed in the book, or else it would not be a realistic portrayal of somebody his size. And I do have to say, the parts of his thinking, his disordered thinking about food, come out of the experience of just being female in the United States of America today. I mean, I can't pretend that I haven't thought some of the things that Arthur thinks, or had some of the really painful experiences with food that Arthur has had, as have a lot of people like me.
And it's interesting you say that, because as I was reading about him, and you do have some lovely descriptions, frankly, of food and how he feels about eating it. It made me think about the kind of obsession that women seem to have, obviously, about weight and appearance. For him, food is something else, but he has some of the same struggles that I think a lot of women have.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I can recall a time when every single one of my friends has gone through a period of, I'll just leave it at disordered eating in some way. Whether or not it reached a point of medical intervention is another story, but I think it's impossible not to know the feeling of both, you know, real cravings and kind of the need or desire to actually binge on food, and also a real reluctance or an inability to act on it also. We're at this weird intersection of abundance in developed nations and also
restrictions,
and real hatred of heft, hatred of overweight or hatred of obesity, and I think that is very troubling.
And did the title Heft, did that come to you after you wrote the book, or did that come as the book was being written?
Let's see. The Heft came to me very definitively as the title of the book, but I was nervous about using it for a couple of reasons. And the stupider one is that one of my mentors is an author named Peter Carey, who's wonderful, and he was the director of my graduate writing program. And he has a book called Theft. And I was really hung up on the idea that I couldn't use Heft, despite the fact that I felt it was very fitting for the book, because I was afraid that it would be stealing somehow from Peter, that he had, you know, it's just one letter different.
He probably didn't feel that way, though.
He didn't at all. And I finally wrote him this confessional email where I said, Peter, I really, really want to use this title, but I'm so afraid of, you know, I really hope that you won't mind if, and all this stuff. And he just wrote back and said, you're being absurd. It's a good title, you said. So.
Just remove the H and
right.
You're fine.
Exactly.
Or the T, rather. Right?
Yeah. But in general, the larger themes of Heft, I mean, beyond just the physical weight of Arthur, I think of the word Heft as also referring to the great weights that all of the characters in the book are carrying around, whether it's bodily weight or whether it's the weight of addiction, as in Charlene, or whether it's Kel, the young, the 17-year-old character who's, in a sense, burdened by his own mother mm-hmm. and all of her stuff that she has, her stuff that she carries around with her. I think of Kel Keller as actually carrying around his mother, which he does at a couple of points in the book.
That's right, his alcoholic
right,
mother.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And Arthur is a professor. Mm-hmm. You're well-educated. You went to college and then graduate mm-hmm. school. You teach now. Is that a world you feel like you understand?
Yes.
Well, and have lived through?
It's interesting because both of my parents are academics in one way or another. And growing up, I always would hear stories about I think they were very lucky in that they both loved their jobs. And they loved learning and were passionate about education and passionate about self-education, more to the point. Especially my mother is one of the most well-read people I've ever met in my life. And so that was a value that was instilled in me pretty early on. And beyond that, I just love the culture of academia. I kind of can't move away from it in my own writing. Even what I'm working on now is set in some way.
Oh, is that right?
I mean, I love everything. This sounds absurd, but I love everything that goes along with learning and everything that goes along with being at a college or university. And I think Arthur did too in the book, and always kind of prided himself on being a part of learning, being a part of academia. And so the loss of I don't think it gives too much away to say he loses that his place in academia pretty early mm-hmm. on in the book.
And loses it, again, without giving too much away, because of what appears to be an inappropriate relationship with Charlene, mm-hmm. who happens to be Kel Keller's mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is innocent. I mean, he clearly mm-hmm. is very fond of her. They have a lifelong correspondence that mm-hmm. they continue. So there's connection, but it's misunderstood.
Right, yeah.
People read into it what isn't really there.
Their connection, Charlene Turner's connection with Arthur Opp, is the kind of the premise of the book. A couple of decades ago, at the start of the book, Charlene Turner was a student in Arthur Opp's class. And I think his connection with her, as you say, was founded much more on being kind of kindred in some way. They recognize something kindred in each other. I think that I actually just stole that line from my own book. But
you're allowed.
They feel similar to one another in the way that they are lonely, and in the way that they feel kind of left behind by the rest of the world, by their own families.
Yeah.
And so their connection isn't as much a romantic one as a platonic one. Although I do think they have romantic feelings toward one another as well.
But they don't act on it.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Yeah. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with a writer, musician, also an assistant professor of writing at Holy Family College, which is here in Philadelphia. Our guest is Liz Moore, and she's got a new book we're talking about, and it's called Heft. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Some more readings as well. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
This fall, Arizona and Michigan will be important battlegrounds in the presidential race, and the Republican candidates have already been campaigning hard in those states. I'm Melissa Block. Tomorrow, voters will decide the next two contests in the race for the Republican nomination, and we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Special coverage of the Arizona and Michigan primaries from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
Don't act like you don't care about the Oscars, but why do we care? Is it the films, the fashion, or waiting for the most cringeworthy speech? We will hear about it all. Who won, who lost, and who wore the most head-turning outfit. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Sarah Seventh Generation supports WHYY, makers of plant-based 4X laundry detergent, a cold water clean in a cardboard bottle. Energy and money-saving laundry tips are available at seventhgeneration.com. Seventh Generation, caring today for seven generations of tomorrows.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Liz Moore is our guest. She's written her second novel. It's called Heft. And it's about the parallel and intersecting lives of an unlikely pair, an obese middle-aged shut-in, a man named Arthur Opp, and a high school basketball star. And his name is Kel Keller. And I would love to have you, Liz, before we even have a reading about Kel Keller. It's interesting that you have your two protagonists, in a way, your two narrators are males. You're not an obese, middle-aged, shut-in professor, nor are you a baseball prodigy.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it's something, I don't know how much of it was conscious and how much of it was subconscious, but there was something very liberating about writing both characters because they were so different from me physically and so different from me in the terms of the circumstances of my life that I think I was able to focus on, I was able to project a lot of the things that I had felt over the course of my life without having every reader naturally assume that it's me.
Of course.
But of course now they know that it's me. But but I think, I mean, it's really, there's a thing that I call when I'm writing and it's like scratching an itch. If I'm really interested in a topic or I could feel like I could write about a particular idea or a theme forever and ever, that's how I know that it maybe could be sustained over the course of a novel. And both Arthur and Kel felt like that to me. And so the fact of their maleness or the fact that one is obese, which I am not, and one is athletic, which I am certainly not, just differentiated them from me enough so that I felt like I could inject them with myself safely.
And these two characters, though, have deep loneliness. I mean, they're searching for things. There's a father theme, I think, that runs through the novel as well. You're interested in loneliness?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of I've had a couple of conversations with people that have centered on the idea that our loneliness is increasing in the world. Maybe I always say in developed nations because I think we're in a weird, I think there's a great difference between growing up in the United States and growing up elsewhere where we don't have all of the kind of opportunities that we have. But here we are surrounded by people a lot, but then again, we are profoundly lonely in other ways. And the proliferation of technology certainly has contributed to that. But beyond that, it just feels like even the forms of technology that are coming out, it's almost like you're slowly losing different parts of the human being. So first we were able to see each other all the time. And then even after that, we would speak, we would hear each other's voices on the phone. And now there's texts, very few people even talk on the phone anymore. So I guess that in this moment in history, it's easy to just kind of forget about the people who don't have immediate family.
Well, even thinking of Arthur Opp, who is a shut-in, and the only people he sees is the guy that delivers the packages that he orders online. There is a young woman who comes and starts to clean his house, but he's largely isolated from the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think of Arthur as someone who kind of is obsessed with his own loneliness, I've said it, he's like a student of his own loneliness. He monitors it and he kind of keeps track of it, and he's interested in it. He's interested in how lonely he can possibly be, and he thinks of it as, I think in the book he says once that he thinks of it as something almost holy, like he's a hermit or something, and he's trying to offer it up to some higher thing. And I'm not sure if that's an excuse that he's making, but there's, over the course of my own life, I can recall a number of people that I've met that I can't forget because of how just utterly lonely they must have been. Yeah. And they kind of haunt me. I can't let go of them.
Well, it's interesting to think of being solitary, and for some people, being alone, can be meditative. I mean, there are ways of being sort of with yourself or with the world when you're not with other people. But this is something different.
Yeah.
It's wanting something out
yes.
there, but being afraid to
Absolutely.
Go get it.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge difference between intentional solitude and unintentional solitude. And Arthur does not want to be alone, although he might tell himself that it's okay. He's really craving something deeply throughout the whole book. And I think it's... Writing this book made me really think about the responsibilities that we all have to one another to ensure that those who do not wish to be alone are not alone, which I think is something that it's easy to put out of our minds.
Now, Kel is this star baseball player. As you said, you weren't, what, much of an athlete?
Not particularly. My greatest sadness in high school was that I was not much of an athlete.
But he's a very, very good athlete and a star, really a prodigy when it comes to baseball. But you also have a section where he talks about the kind of loneliness in his life, and I'd love to have you read that.
Sure. This is from Cal Keller's voice. Baseball is the loneliest sport to play for someone who does not have a father. Everyone's dad lines up behind the chain-link fence at games. Everyone's dad has a catch with them in the backyard. Everyone's dad tells them stories about great games and teams and players, pounds them with phrases like, keep your eye on the ball, swing through, swing through, get in front of the ball, get in front of the ball, get in front of the goddamn ball. I was not given these by anyone but coaches. Still, I made them my own. I would chant them all day. At night, I would turn on the radio and listen to Charlie Rasko, the sportscaster, tell me about sports. This was how I fell asleep. He told me a lot of things I would not otherwise have known, and I pretended it was my father telling me these things. I am embarrassed, but it's true. After school, I would practice in the tiny dirt yard behind our house. I propped an old mattress against the back wall. My mother drew a red circle on it and a red dot inside the circle. I threw the ball at the mattress over and over again. When my mother was up for it, I had her bat ground balls to me, and I scooped them. This was rare. I did not want to be a pitcher, but as a younger boy, I was. When I was 12, I was on an all-star team that went to the Little League World Series in central Pennsylvania. My mother took off work as soon as she found out we were going, which was especially hard because it was right before school started. Her car at the time was a horrible old Nissan that broke down when we were only half an hour away, and we almost didn't make it. I remember her standing on the side of the road, going, I'm so sorry, baby. I'm so sorry, Kel. I was very mean to her and would not talk. An old man in a baseball cap pulled over in a pickup truck and asked, were we all right? And my mother told him no. My son's on his way to the Little League World Series, she said. You better come with me then, said the old man. I could tell that my mother did not want to, but she did it for me. She sat in the middle, and I sat on the far side, and the old man called a towing company and got my mother's car towed for her. He was a very nice man and nothing to fear. He told us jokes on the way. Did you hear the Cubs got a new pitching machine? Yep, beat 'em 5-1. He asked me who my favorite player of all time was, and I told him Mike Schmidt. Attaboy, he said, because we were in Pennsylvania. We got a phone call later from the garage. He'd paid for our car to be towed and fixed. My mother cried.
That's a great. I love that section, and that's Liz Moore reading from her second novel, and it's called Heft, and it's about a baseball prodigy, a high school player named Kel Keller. That's the narrator that you just heard, and the other narrator in this novel is a guy named Arthur Opp. He's a shut-in, had been a college professor, and they are linked in unusual ways. I love that section because I think you really tap into what I often hear from men that I know about the kind of hunger they have for their dads. Even if they have a dad mm-hmm. and had a relationship with a dad, there's this desire for a kind of closeness that they feel like they really don't have.
Yeah, isn't
and they
that
can't
sad?
Attain. It is sad.
I mean, it's very. I think it's for. I was hesitant also to write the experience of a young man in this book because I always have a fear that I'm going to misrepresent somebody's situation. But Kel is based on a lot of the kids I grew up with.
Is that right?
I grew up in a town called Framingham, Massachusetts, which is a wonderful place and very diverse and has a real mix of all classes and all races. And so I think that Kel is similar in my mind to a lot of the kids that I grew up with who seemed in some way underparented, but also had this obsession with performing a kind of real bravado or machismo, or were kind of like, you could just see in their little faces, like how crushed they'd be if they didn't catch a ball, or if they struck out.
But then, if their dad didn't show up at a game.
I know, which is in some ways a cliche. I mean, you see that scene over and over again in film and TV, but I think there's a reason for it. I mean, I think the place of primacy in a young man's life that his father has, or the absence of his father has in Kel's case, can't really be underestimated.
Yeah. And Kel, in a sense, goes on a kind of a quest to figure out who his father is. And I don't want to give too much away. Actually, I'm not going to give too much away because there are interesting and kind of subtle things that happen. But these two men, two very different men on a very parallel track, but their lives intersect in unusual ways.
Yeah, I think both of them are looking for family in a way. And I mean, Arthur Opp is looking for a family that he can kind of cobble together himself. He's had various friends over the years that have served that purpose for him, but they've all gone out of his life for one reason or another. And Kel is literally looking for family. He wants to know who his father is.
Right.
I think that as a writer, there has to be something driving your characters. And for both Kel and Arthur, that the drive was family, looking for something out there that would tell them they belonged in the world, which in a sense is what your family is.
Indeed.
You know? It's what tells you you belong in the world.
And his Kel's mother has a drinking problem, and he as the only child has to take care of her, as you said, literally carry her sometimes. And he's furious with her. Obviously, he's young, and here he is saddled with the responsibility of a troubled mother.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's tough.
Kel is, he's in a kind of a double predicament because he's got an alcoholic mother and he's poor, sort of as a fact. He's poor. And the other part of that problem is that he goes to a really wealthy school. I made it up. It's not a real school.
Pell, right?
Pell's Landing, right, which is a fictional town in Westchester that I created to serve the particular purpose that I needed. So he's not only has a lot of troubles at home, but he's constantly surrounded with what he perceives to be kind of perfection, like all these kids that are living effortless lives and are effortlessly wealthy and effortlessly kind of graceful and well-dressed. And the time he spends comparing himself to them was another place that I was interested in exploring in this book.
And he says they spoke like rich adults.
Yeah, which, I mean, I can't... I think because I grew up with parents that I grew up. First of all, I had some experience with loneliness growing up because I was an only, and I have a much younger sister who I adore now, but she's so much younger than me that for most of my childhood I was alone and I didn't have cousins my age and I was mostly around adults. So when I was little, I felt very much like an adult, and so I had the reverse of Kel when I was growing up, where I felt like I was speaking another language than every other kid, because I couldn't figure out how to talk like everyone else. And that was my problem. How to fit in, exactly. That was my problem. And Kel, although he's been blessed with beauty, I mean, he's a handsome kid, and athleticism and popularity, he also is constantly struggling to figure out how to fit in or how to make himself like other people.
And I think that's one thing you learn when you look back on your adolescence and then you talk to people that also that look like they had it together in their adolescence and you realize that everybody, no one knew what they were doing.
Isn't that the truth? And
yes.
I have this like horrible fear that I was secretly like awful when I was a kid or in high school because I think like a lot of writers, I always felt like a misfit or I didn't quite know what I was doing. And I think I really perceived myself as this victim and, not that I was like totally,
were you
of course
picked on
had
or?
Friends. Not even so much. I just felt, like an outsider. But I have this horrible fear that actually, in retrospect, I was the one that was awful, And I think it's this
judging sense, others, right?
Exactly. And I think it's this sense of, I think every teenager just feels like they have no idea what they're doing. And
some are just better actors, I think.
I think
others.
That's true. Yeah, I think that's true.
So were you a reader?
Oh, yes. I read more between the ages of probably 5 and 18 than I will ever read for the rest of my life. Sadly, I wish I had more time to read for pleasure. And I make an effort to now. But the years that I spent feeling lonely, you know, as a kid, I funneled that energy into reading, and I built a world of books all around me, and I spent so much time reading that I think my grandparents were concerned at a certain point and tried to like stage an intervention, like go outside
and play.
Exactly. So that, I mean, that has served me as a writer, certainly. But I wasn't reading out of happiness as a kid. I was reading because I felt like it was the only, it was a relief for me. It was a respite.
Were you a shy kid?
Oh, terribly shy kid.
Really?
Like
awkwardly,
terribly shy, to the point where, you know, I have distinct memories of my mother's like pants leg. That's my, you know, pressing my face into my mom's pants until I was too big to do that because I couldn't stand the idea of reaching out, or, you know, interacting with anyone, really. I did better with adults. Conversely, I think the reverse is usually true, probably for most kids. But I loved to talk to adults, and I would talk to any adult. But with kids my own age, I felt very shy, which has changed. I'm pretty outgoing now. But you know, as a kid, I did spend a lot of time being quite shy.
And were you afraid of being called on in class?
No, I was a know-it-all.
Are you? Class. Oh, okay.
So I would talk to my teacher, and I would. You know, I shouldn't say that. I did have my hand in the air a lot, but there would come a point, and I think it was part of trying to figure out how best to fit in, where I would actually sort of measure. I would think, okay, I've raised my hand 3 times in the past hour. I should probably not raise my hand again for another hour or something, you know. Just ridiculous in retrospect, but it was a part of, I think I was trying to create like a code of behavior for myself because I couldn't figure it out.
And were you, I don't want to, you know, make this a sad sex story, but in the lunchroom, would you eat with other kids? Or
I would eat with other kids. But yeah, I mean, you know what's funny? I think all of my life has gotten better and better in terms of social interaction. So the hardest part for me of growing up was not high school or middle school, but elementary school. And once I got to high school, I had a pretty good high school experience. College was terrific. I really like my life right now. But as a young, really young kid, yeah, lunch was difficult, recess was difficult, any kind of like unmonitored free activity I dreaded, which again every other kid would have probably kicked me if they heard me say that, because that's the dream, right? Unmonitored elementary school activities. But I liked structure because I felt like I would know what to do and where to be.
And did you have teachers in high school that recognized some of your writing talents?
I did. I had an absolutely wonderful experience throughout Framingham's public schools, and just a number of really remarkable teachers. And now that I teach myself, I think I can recognize truly how gifted they were as teachers. I don't think you realize how hard teaching is until you're doing it.
Indeed.
And trying to be, it feels in a way like performing sometimes, trying to keep everybody engaged and learning at the same time. So yeah, throughout Framingham Public School, I had great teachers. In college, I had the privilege of working with writers like Mary Gordon and Roddy Doyle. And then in my grad school program at Hunter, I worked with Peter Carey, Colin McCann, and Nathan Englander. So I had quite a roster of well-known writers kind of guiding me throughout my career, my learning.
Your learning. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to pick up on all of that and quickly reintroduce you. Liz Moore is our guest today on Radio Times. She's actually written her second novel. It's called Heft. She also worked as a musician in a very well-known music store in New York City. I do want to talk about that. Had a band release a CD a couple of years ago. We are talking about writing and her life. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Van Gogh Up Close, paintings from Vincent Van Gogh's final years, when the artist developed radical new ways of capturing nature on canvas. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is the only U.S. venue for this exhibition. Tickets for Van Gogh Up Close are available now, online at philomuseum.org or 215-235-SHOW. That's 215-235-SHOW.
Journalist Craig Timberg says for years, international AIDS groups overlooked important factors in the spread of the HIV virus, like the effectiveness of circumcision.
The difference between the men who were circumcised and the men who weren't was 8-1 in terms of their infectiousness.
On the next Fresh Air, Timberg explores the history of the virus and efforts to fight the AIDS epidemic. His new book is Tinderbox. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Poetry can give shape and voice to our darkest feelings of suffering. Research shows writing about difficult moments can be an extraordinarily freeing experience, leading to a sense of safety, renewed energy, and restored order. On the next Voices in the Family, Dan Gottlieb talks with author and teacher Ellen Bass about poetry as a tool for healing. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Liz Moore. Her first novel, The Words of Every Song, was published shortly after she graduated from college, and that was around the same time her first CD, Backyards, was released. She was in her early 20s. She's now written a second novel called Heft, and it's about the parallel and intersecting lives of a middle-aged, obese shut-in and a gifted high school baseball star. We're talking about writing and her life, and I do want to talk about music as well. She's an assistant professor of writing at Holy Family College, which is here in Philadelphia. 1-888-477-9499. So how did a shy girl become a musician and a performer?
Well, I always liked music. I took piano when I was younger, and I learned guitar. I taught myself guitar around the time I was 16 or 17. And I liked to sing. I always liked to sing. And I think that performing kind of helped me to not be so shy, I mean, by necessity. But I do remember, I think I started out just by playing open mics. I went to college at Barnard, which is in New York City, and I would go out and play open mics in New York and just be utterly terrified for the first, you know, few that I did. But after that, I really grew to love it and began to play shows out and formed a band, and then the band disbanded, and now I play solo whenever I have a chance to. And that's kind of the story of music.
Were you in high school musicals? Did you do that route?
I was in middle school musicals. I had a great jazz. I did this like morning program that, speaking of terrific teachers, Mr. Fazio at Fuller Middle School.
A shout out. Right.
Put on a morning, just out of the goodness of his heart, 6 a.m. or something, we showed up and we would sing in this choir, and he took an interest in me and I think helped me to be cast in a musical. And then mostly, I didn't do it in high school, but I did get into guitar.
So what musical was that, and what role did you play?
It was Oliver, and I was Nancy.
Oh, you
which
were?
Is, I could probably still sing the whole score. I won't, but
that's great.
It was a great experience.
Now, you worked at Matt Umanoff's guitar store, which is in Greenwich Village, a well-known place. Did you just wander in and get a job there?
I didn't just wander in and get a job. Sort of. I wanted a summer job. I was going to stay in New York in between years at Barnard. And so I went in about June, and I dropped my resume off. I thought it would be a great place to work because I was very into music at that time and playing pretty regularly. And I didn't get a call until about 6 months later, when Matt, the owner, called me and said, "Hey, I just found your resume. You're still interested in working?" And at this time I was right in the middle of the busiest time of one's college career. And I remember thinking like, this is a cool opportunity. I should probably do this. And so I ended up working Saturdays and Sundays at Matt Umanoff's, for
behind the counter,
register. And occasionally selling guitars, mostly to small children, because the level of expertise that every other employee had there far surpassed my own.
But what a great place to work, even more than just a musician, but also as a novelist, I'm assuming, to get material for your writing.
Yeah, every walk of life came into Matt Umanoff Guitars. There were a lot of tourists because it was in the village. There were a lot of famous people that came in, which was made it an amazing job for a college student because there were lots of stories to tell my friends. And it was a terrific guitar store, and more than the famous musicians, I was interested in just the working musicians who would come in regularly. And that's where I kind of began to get the ideas for my book, The Words of Every Song, which I wrote when I was very young. I was still in college when I wrote most of that book. But it's a series of interconnected short stories, and each one of them features the same cast of characters, but a different one prominently. And a lot of them were based on people, mm-hmm. strangers that I had seen and just working in that store.
So, who were some of the famous people?
Oh goodness, let's see. Now that you're putting me on the spot, Rosemary. Oh my gosh,
Roseanne Cash.
No. Roseanne Cash, thank you. I was about to say Rosemary Clooney. Not Rosemary Clooney. Roseanne Cash, Billy Joe Armstrong, Mike Myers came in. I sold him a baby Taylor once. He had a hockey stick with him. I'll stop because my mind's going blank. There were a lot.
But there were a lot.
Yeah.
It seems you've been lucky. Mm-hmm. Through high school, you've had these teachers that seem to really resonate with you. And then in college and even in graduate school, Roddy Doyle, Mary Gordon, and mm-hmm. others who seem to help you, I guess, as a writer. And I'm interested in that relationship between the professor and the student when it comes to writing.
So,
how do you think they helped you?
Yeah, the very best thing that a professor of creative writing can do is to be a working writer, in my opinion, and to let their students know how much effort it takes to actually sit there and write a novel, because I think that's something that really can't be conveyed. Additionally, it's important to just be very passionate about reading, mm-hmm. and to bring in good models for students to work from, and to really just let the student know that as much, I think that inspiration's the easiest thing, and after that, it's just work. That's the only, I tell my own students the same thing. It's just work. So there's a certain level of talent that's innate, but beyond that, I really do think it's about the amount of effort that you put in.
And do you struggle with that? I mean, are you constantly editing your work, your material? Rethinking it,
yes. A lot of time I spend sitting at the computer is just staring at the computer, which I realize more and more now that I'm working on a new project, which is much slower going than working on a project that's been underway for a while. But the work is just convincing yourself that despite the fact that nothing has come to you for the past half an hour, you still have to keep sitting there until something does. Because after 30 minutes of nothing, it's really easy to just get up and walk away. But I find that if I give myself specific time periods and know that I'm not allowed to leave, almost 100% of the time, at least something will come.
And when you're sitting there, nothing is coming. Mm-hmm. Are you typing? And nothing is coming. Or are you waiting?
I'm waiting.
You're waiting for those words?
Yeah, I'm watching the cursor blink. Sometimes I'm gazing off. I just bought a house, and the house has a nice view out one of its windows. So sometimes I look out the window. And so a lot of times I work in coffee shops. And that's good because you can catch snippets of conversation, and you can do character sketches, which is something that I'm fond of doing as a way of just imagining other people's lives, building stories around strangers that you see.
You must have to learn how to be patient and be willing to sit there when, as you say, nothing is happening. I mean, certainly something is going on, but it hasn't turned into something that you can put on the paper.
Absolutely. And can I tell you that, speaking of technology, I mean, the bane of any writer's existence is technology. And I use it for research, so in that way it's good, mm-hmm. but I have to I'm like a child. I have to force myself to turn off my cell phone completely, or I'll check it. I have to force myself. I use this application called Freedom, which is kind of poetically named, but it forcibly shuts off all of the internet applications on your computer so that it turns your computer into a word processor, basically. Otherwise, I will sit there, and if nothing comes, it's time to check my email. It's time
to go to eBay or something like that.
Right, exactly. So in that way, I restrict all technology when I'm writing, and it's the only way I can get anything done. Because I think you don't even realize how habitual it is to check your email. It's become a tick almost in a lot of people's lives.
So do you do this every day? Or do you give yourself weekends off?
I do give myself some days off a week. I'm getting better. Since Heft came out at the end of January, I've been busy with doing stuff related to Heft. So this has been a slow month for writing, mm-hmm. but I feel I'm on a little bit of a high right now because I'm working on what I think is a good new thing.
Excellent.
And so this week has been particularly productive, so I'm happier than I was last week.
And is there such a thing as inspiration? I mean, where you might be walking or driving or doing something, and then something comes?
Not as much.
An image, a word, phrase?
When I was younger, that happened more. When I was a kid, I feel like there was some, maybe kids are more closely connected to God or closely connected to whatever, you know, inspires you. But I remember just feeling like a whole poem just fell out of the sky, and it wasn't necessarily a good poem. But now it's really, it's very rare that something will come to me in any form. I'll think about something I'd like to write about, and then it's just sitting. I guess I do a lot of sitting when I'm writing. But really, I encourage all writers to just buy some Velcro and just force yourself to sit.
To sit down at that. And you're not the first writer to say that. Let me tell you.
Exactly.
The Words of Every Song, your first novel, got, you know, really nice reviews. Roddy Doyle writing a blurb on the back of the book. Was there pressure? Did you feel pressure with a second novel? You know, can I do this again or do it better?
Well, you know what's funny? Speaking of things that fell from the sky, the first novel was almost a fluke that it got published. I mean, not to undermine the work that other people did to get it published, but, you know, I sort of stumbled onto an agent, and she sort of looked at it and said, oh, I think I can probably sell this. And then she sold it in a couple weeks, and I was 22 when I signed my first book contract, and I think... Mm-hmm. All of us, even my family, I think, was just sort of like, is this what? We didn't even know how excited to be, because it was, I think, now that I've seen a lot of my friends going through this same process, and my second book was a much more difficult process in terms of getting it published. I didn't know how lucky I was. So I think because I didn't even know to have high expectations for the first book, this second book, Heft, has felt more like my debut in a way, because of the amount of work it took to write, because of the amount of work it took to get it published. It was a slower process getting it published this time. And because I think I felt more invested in some way in this book. So I was very nervous about the release of this book, and I'm very happy with how W.W. Norton has handled it. I mean, I think I like them a lot because they're a large independent publishing company, so they have, I think, an interesting approach to books in general.
Have you ever thought about food writing?
No. Do you think I should think about food writing?
Well, you have very vivid descriptions of food. In fact, I'd love to have you read another section from the book.
Yeah, absolutely. This is in Arthur Opp's voice. I needed consolation, so I made a feast for myself. Cookies made from coconut and macadamias and white chocolate. A bowl of peanut M&Ms. A few bagels coated obscenely with seeds and grains and tasty little granules of salt. Bagels laden with heavy coats of butter and cream cheese and topped with a lonesome tomato slice, red and bleeding with juice. A pitcher of whole milk and a tall glass next to it. An Oreo-crusted chocolate cake. 3 hamburgers and potato salad and creamed spinach that I had delivered from the diner on 7th Avenue. I warmed the spinach on my stove. I put a dollop of cream cheese in the center of it, white in a sea of pearly green. I gave myself permission to eat all of this and felt the thrilling release that such permission delivers. A soft little munching sound escaped me, and immediately I tensed. I hate hearing myself. I do not talk to myself. I do not have conversations with myself in my home the way I imagine some people do. It's silly. My own voice repulses me. Suddenly I remembered why I love very much to be alone, why I love to be utterly alone in my own quiet house, and love not to be looked at. I had a very entertaining book to read. I turned on the radio, and just by good luck, it was Michelangeli's version of a prelude by Debussy called La Fille aux Cheveux de Lin, which always calls to mind a specific memory of summertime. In this moment, I was happy.
And again, that's Liz Moore reading from her new novel called Heft. As you said, you're working on something else, or something else is working on you.
It's probably a better way to put it. Yeah, I have that itch that I feel like I have to scratch again where I'm interested. I'm hesitant to call it a novel yet because I feel superstitious about using that word because I've started so many and abandoned so many. But it's a project that has to do with science in some way. My father is a physicist who specializes in nuclear medicine, so in addition to growing up around my mother, who's an English professor and loves literature, I had a great deal of exposure to the processes of research science, so, and the world of research science, and whatever it is that I'm working on deals with themes of science and technology, and is written, it focuses on a young woman this time, which is good. I'm happy to return to writing about a woman. It feels like home in some way.
Well, we're going to close things out with a song from your CD that came out in 2007, the CD called Backyards. And can you just very quickly tell us about Safe and Sad, what the song is about?
Sure. This song, it's about the end of a relationship, like a lot of songs. And it's also about the beginning of a new relationship.
Well, on that note, Liz Moore, again, thank you very much. Congratulations on your novel, and thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's been a huge pleasure.
Well, a pleasure for us as well. And she's an assistant professor of writing at Holy Family College. That's here in Philadelphia. And again, her second novel, her new novel, is called Heft. And we are going to close things out with a song from her 2007 album called Backyards, a song called Safe and Sound. Emily Bryant is the Radio Times intern, Kevin Griffin the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder with Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And we are going to close things out with Safe and Sad.